We are so grateful to Dr. Deepak Chopra. And we'll have a session till about 5 o'clock and then a small break. I request those of you who want to ask any questions for the interactive session, which would be of about 45 minutes, please write down questions very, very briefly, and then at 5 o'clock you can hand it over to us. We'll try and group them together so that he could answer them in one go. And I'll not stand between you and Dr. Deepak Chopra, the pulsating energy of consciousness who's so conscious of his own consciousness. Dr. Deepak Chopra.
Do I need that or just this? Huh? Okay, so. Okay, so this morning we spoke about, in a way we laid out the map for the evolution of consciousness and how a true healing is really always a spiritual healing. And the definition of spirit is really consciousness. Spirit, awareness, consciousness, soul, they're all part of the same continuum. What I was hoping to do this afternoon was show you what happens once one develops intimate connection with one's own consciousness. Is everyone able to hear me? Are you able to hear me in the back clearly, or do you want me to get another microphone? Or you're fine? Okay. Consciousness by itself is non-local. Non-local simply means that it has no location in space or time. And today one is finding a lot of literature on non-locality in the field of quantum physics. Non-local in spiritual terms is also transcendent. So when people say, where is my soul? That question is not really a good question. Because when you say where, you imply a location in space and time to something. You know, in various spiritual literatures, the soul is here, or the soul is here, or the soul is somewhere in the body. I think what is really meant is that it localizes. The soul can localize through a particular location into the body. After all, in order to express itself through your body, it must localize. But just like when I listen, let's say I listen to Pandit Ravi Shankar on my radio, and I look inside the radio, I'm not going to find Pandit Ravi Shankar inside the radio. And the reason I'm not going to find him inside the radio is he's not inside the radio. And yet, his music localizes through the radio. So your soul is not your body. That's a very wrong concept, that the soul is in the body. Say, when somebody dies, the soul leaves the body. That's not true at all. It's the other way around. When somebody dies, their body leaves the soul. The soul being non-local, it has nowhere to go. Let's say something happened to this room. Then what happens to the space inside the room? Nothing. The space is now localized inside these walls. And when we destroy the walls and the roof, the space becomes non-local, but nothing actually happens to the space. It's always there. You can neither create the space nor can you destroy the space. But you can give it localized expression. So too, you can neither create the soul nor can you destroy the soul. You can give it a localized expression as in a sentient being or in a physical body. It's very important for us to understand that reality is non-local. Reality is non-local and Maya is local. So, in reality, everybody here is a non-local being. You know, these days if you go to a good bookstore, you might find a lot of books on what they call out-of-body experiences. Which is interesting because even though people are talking about out-of-body experiences, the real mystery is how do we get an in-body experience? Because technically speaking, we are not inside the body. The fact that you experience yourself inside a body is another perceptual artifact. The fact that you experience yourself inside a body is also a perceptual artifact. It's a hallucination. Non-local is transcendent, beyond space-time. In the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna talks about the soul, he says, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, weapons cannot cleave it, fire cannot burn it, it has no beginning, it has no ending. Now please try and conceptualize that and you'll find it's impossible. Also, if you talk to modern physicists, they say the universe has no beginning in time, no ending in time, no edges in space. If you read Stephen Hawking's book, for example, A Brief History of Time, you'll find that statement. We live in a universe that has no beginning in time, no ending in time, and no edges in space. Try and conceptualize that, and your mind will reel with bewilderment. Because if you say there was a beginning in time, if there was a beginning in time, then the immediate question is, so if there was a beginning, what was there before the beginning? If there's an ending, then as soon as you say there's an ending, the immediate question is, what's there after the ending? If you say there are edges to space, then the immediate question is, what's there after the outermost edge? See, if you go either way, you're in the midst, in the horns of a dilemma. And the reason is, quantum physics, as we now understand it, is not only stranger than we think it is, it's stranger than we can think. We cannot conceptualize reality. But we try to. And mathematics, it's very easy to conceptualize reality because all you do is you use a symbol. You write a symbol like this and you say infinity. But you can't conceptualize infinity. You write a symbol like this, you say zero. But conceptualize what that means, you can't. Therefore, anything that you can conceptualize is not real. If you can see it, if you can conceptualize it, if you can experience it through your senses, if I can see it, if I can touch it, if I can taste it, if I can smell it, if I can imagine it, if I can visualize it, if I can conceptualize it, it's not real. Now what's real? Without which I cannot see, without which I cannot conceptualize, without which I cannot imagine, without which I cannot perceive, but which itself is non-conceptualizable. And that's non-local consciousness. And that's the reality. Anything that can be seen, perceived, conceptualized, imagined is not real, but depends on something which cannot be conceptualized, imagined, visualized, or perceived. And that something is consciousness. It is this consciousness that conceives, that governs, that constructs, and that ultimately becomes what we call mind, and through the mind it becomes what we call matter. And in a biological organism, through that material body, there's perception, there's cognition, there are feelings, there are moods, there are emotions, there's biological activity, there are social interactions, there's an environment, and there's the whole cosmos that is projected as a result of the self-interacting dynamics of a non-local, non-conceptualizable, transcendent reality.
That reality is what our great spiritual traditions talk about. Now when it localizes, of course, it localizes in our physiology through activity that is both local and non-local. Local means linear interactions, non-local means interactions that are in the world of simultaneity. The interdependent co-arising of events. In a human biological organism such as you and me, this localization is felt to be through what we call, again, in our Indian vocabulary, we call this localization happens through the seven chakras. The seven chakras are the gateways for the non-local, eternal, transcendent, beyond space-time, ultimate reality that localizes in our biology through the seven chakras. The chakras are really metaphors for how consciousness, which is non-local, becomes local. And in so doing, it expresses itself, consciousness expresses itself through biology. The biological responses that we have in certain situations, they're all expressions of consciousness localizing. So just like there are seven chakras, there are seven biological responses that correspond to these chakras. And these biological responses can be studied in terms of physiology. The first biological response is known as the fight and flight response. The fight and flight response. It's the most primitive response that we have. It's been going on in our physiology for millions of years. So in evolutionary time, according to modern biological evolutionary theories, human beings as Homo sapiens have existed for about 200,000 years. And the first response that we developed as biological organisms was what we call the fight-flight response, which means that when there's a threatening situation, then we either run or we fight. Okay, it's also called the stress response. So in a very ferocious environment, if you're surrounded by ferocious animals, then the only way to survive in that ferocious environment is either to fight the predator or run away. And because of the fight-flight response, we have survived as a human species. In a life-threatening situation, that's an appropriate response, to fight or to run. But now, since we are no longer living in that environment where we were surrounded by ferocious animals who wanted to enjoy us for breakfast, lunch and dinner, the response in most situations is inappropriate. So when you have an inappropriate fight-flight response, we call that stress. Stress is nothing but an inappropriate fight-flight response. It's the perception of physical or psychological threat. In a truly dangerous situation, that would be very appropriate. You know, your adrenal glands secrete a lot of adrenaline and cortisol, your blood pressure rises, your heart rate becomes very fast, your sweat gland activity increases, your body temperature increases, your platelets get sticky. All of this is very appropriate because you need to run, you need to increase your metabolic rate, you need to increase your heart rate, you need to increase your blood pressure, you need to increase your sweat gland activity so you can get rid of excessive body heat through evaporation of your sweat glands, your pupils dilate. All of this is survival. But if the situation is not dangerous and you're not going to run, all of this becomes self-destructive. So the fight-flight response is responsible for all the epidemics that we know of modern times. Cardiovascular illness, heart disease, hypertension, cardiac arrhythmias, sticky platelets, all of this is inappropriate fight-flight response, and it's the number one disease of our civilization. The number one epidemic of our civilization. Stress. It's a survival response, but when it's inappropriate, that's what happens. The second response that we have as human beings, biologically, is what might be called the reactive response. The reactive response is, it's not a survival response of the physical body, but it's the survival response of the ego. When your ego is threatened, then you react. So just like the body has a fight-flight response, your ego has a reactive response. And the reactive response that the ego has is of four kinds. You try and control a threatening situation, either by confrontation or intimidation. So you confront the other person and you scream at him, you get angry, confrontation or intimidation. The second way that you try and control the situation is through stubbornness or withdrawal. The third way that you could try and control the situation is to manipulate the situation by being extremely nice but manipulative. So you're either nice or you're nasty or you're stubborn. These are the three control dramas. And if none of them works, then you play the victim, poor me. So if you want to summarize the reactive response, there are four types of control dramas. Nice, nasty, stubborn, and poor me. And we learn these control dramas at a very early stage of our lives. About three years of age, they start to get, we become very skillful. So, you know, this little baby, boy or girl, goes out with his mother, and she's shopping, and the boy wants that toy, and mother says, "You can't have it." What does the baby do? Baby lies down on the ground and starts screaming. Mother says, "You can't have it." Then the baby says to the mother, "Mommy, please, will you give it to me? I love you very much." Mother says, "No." Then they go home. The baby hides in the cupboard and becomes indifferent and stubborn and withdraws. Mother says, "No." And then the baby starts to become the victim. "You don't love me, you love my brother, but you don't love me, you're not nice to me." By then, the mother says, "Okay, I'll buy you the toy." So at 3 years, the reactive response, more or less, is quite effective. But when you're 30 years, it's not so effective, mostly because you're not so cute anymore. So what really psychologists are telling us is that the reactive response, the control response, the emotional response that we call the control response, it starts at about 3 years, and it becomes you become very skillful by the age of 8 years, and that most people do not go beyond that in an adult life. You can be president of the country, but something happens, you either are nice, or you're nasty, or you're stubborn, or you play the victim. And that 99.99% of humanity is either in the fight-flight response or the reactive response. 99.99%. That includes our great leaders of the world, who we trust to run our countries and our multinational corporations. So these are the two responses that have been around for a long time. The third response is what we call the restful awareness response, or you might also call it the restful alertness response. And this is the first time that human beings can transcend both reactivity and fight flight. Restful awareness response is what we experience in meditation. When you're in meditation, your body is rested and your mind is alert. Your mind is not asleep. Your mind is awake. Your mind is fully awake and your body is fully rested. Restful awareness response is also what we call self-referred consciousness, because consciousness is not referring back to the ego. It's going beyond the ego and referring back to the soul. And when we are in restful awareness, then we are independent of the good or bad opinion of others. We are in touch with our emotions, we join the evolutionary stream of existence, we are more or less effortless, we are detached from that which is trivial and mundane, and we are much more spontaneous in our activity because our ego is not in the way. According to evolutionary biologists, human beings discovered the restful awareness response about 6,000 years ago, when the sages of the Upanishads in India, the rishis, Socrates and Parmenides, and Plato and Pythagoras in Greece, Lao Tzu, Confucius in the Far East, we had the emergence of what today people call the axial sages. Simultaneously, around the world, there are great beings who are transforming the world and transforming consciousness by going into a deeper state, by going into samadhi. Samadhi, restful awareness, the third response. It has its own physiological correlates. But how many people have that? Very few. The luminaries of civilization are the luminaries of civilization because they were able to go beyond the fight-flight response and they were able to go beyond the reactive response into the restful awareness response. The fourth response, biologically, after restful awareness is we call the intuitive response. Intuition is a form of intelligence that is contextual. It's not linear. Intuition is contextual, it's relational, it's holistic, it is nurturing, it does not have a win-lose orientation, it goes beyond cause-effect relationships. Intuition is eavesdropping on the mind of the universe. When the intuitive response is appropriate, it has a computing ability which is far beyond anything that occurs in the realms of rational thought. Because rational thought looks at the world in linear manner, in cause-effect relationships. This is the cause of this, and this is the cause of this. Well, that's not really the way the universe functions. The way the universe functions is through interdependent co-arising. Interdependent co-arising means that everything is the cause of everything else. Take the flower. What's the cause of this flower? Well, linearly you'll say a seed. But actually this flower is the whole universe. There's all the elements of nature interdependently acting, the whole history of the universe, sunshine, earth, rainbows and rainfall, and wind and water, the infinite void, the whole history of creation. Actually, you can look at anything. You can look at this table. You say, well, what's the cause of this table? It's a tree. Well, not just a tree. The tree is the forest. It's the ecosystem. It's the carpenter. It's the carpenter's relatives. It's the carpenter's factory. It's employers, employees, trade unions. In fact, this tree, the whole universe is responsible for this tree. You look at anything and you say, what is the cause of this? You can never say, this is the cause of this. Anything that exists, the whole universe interdependently gives rise to everything in creation. And today, scientists also refer to this as the holographic paradigm. What's the holographic paradigm? I think when you look at a hologram, you know, are you familiar with a hologram? Okay, so when the hologram is made, let's say you want to make a hologram of me, the way the hologram is made is, you take a laser beam, you put it through an instrument that's called a beam splitter, it splits the beam into two beams. One beam comes at the object, let's say me, then it gets scattered, the other beam bounces off a photographic plate, it interferes with the scattered light, it creates an interference pattern, then once you create the interference pattern, you put a laser beam through it, and you'll get a three-dimensional holographic projection of the original object. And if a hologram is well made, then you cannot tell the difference between the object that is real and the object that is the hologram. For example, this morning, that was Deepak Chopra giving the lecture. This afternoon, it's the hologram and you don't even know the difference. There's something very mystical and mysterious about a hologram. If you take that photographic plate that we call the hologram and you cut it up into a million bits. Let's say I take the hologram and I take a scissors and I cut it up in a million bits and I take a small bit of it and I put a laser beam through it, I'll get the whole thing back again. So if you take my hologram and you cut it up into a million, trillion, billion, trillion bits, you take the smallest bit, you put a laser beam through it, you'll get all of me all over again. A hologram is immortal. You cannot destroy it. And the reason we call it a hologram is hologram. The whole is contained in every part. Like that, in the universe, which is holographic, the whole universe is contained in every part. The whole universe is contained in that leaf, in that flower, in you. That's why Rumi says, the whole universe exists inside you, ask all from yourself. And that's the intuitive response. The intuitive response is the ability to go into samadhi and ask a question. The ability to go into samadhi and introduce an intention. It's also called Ichha Shakti. Ichha Shakti. That in that field, holographic field, in the depths of your being, you introduce an intention or a question, and the question then orchestrates the fulfillment. You know, I'm sure if you are familiar with the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, they said if you have Dhyan, Dharana and Samadhi at the same time, then you have the Siddhis. Okay? The Siddhis are supernormal powers that come through a combination of Samadhi. Samadhi means the observer, the process of observation and the observed have become one consciousness. You, the observer, the object of your observation and the process of your observation have become one single consciousness, which is the reality anyway. Dharana is in that samadhi you put focused attention. So dhyan, meditation, which takes you there. Dharana, focused attention over there, and samadhi in the field of all possibilities, anything is possible. Okay, so all the siddhis, all the riddhis are expressions of the intuitive response. Intuition is much bigger than we think it is. The universe at its most fundamental levels is a field of possibilities that responds to intention. So we have the fight-flight response, we have the reactive response, we have the restful awareness response, and then we have the intuitive response. What's beyond the intuitive response, biologically? The creative response. So intuition says, okay, I know what's happening. Creative response is, I can create something that never existed before. I can create something that never existed before. The creative response is based on discontinuity. Because true creativity is a context and meaning that transforms into a new context and new meaning without an intervening context or meaning. True creativity is non-algorithmic. An algorithm is a computer program. You know, if I have a computer program, I can feed mathematical formulas that will simulate creativity, but it's not creativity. It's based on algorithms, which means it's predictable. Anytime anything is predictable, it's not creative. True creativity is non-algorithmic, it's quantum, it's a discontinuity, it's a pattern of thought and behavior and a new pattern of thought and behavior with no intervening pattern of thought and behavior. So true creativity comes from the soul, not from the mind. And what we call healing is biological creativity. Because if somebody has a disease, let's say lung cancer or heart disease, then if they are truly to be healed, they have to do something unpredictable. Their biology has to do something unpredictable. If you can predict what's going to happen and prognosticate, that's not creativity. Therefore, true creativity goes through certain processes. First, there's a visualization of the intended outcome. What do you want? Secondly, there's information gathering. Then there's analysis of the information. Then there's incubation in the soul. And then there's a quantum leap of creativity, what we call insight. And from insight, there is integration, inspiration, implementation, incarnation. Actually, those people who understand true creativity says, quantum creativity is death. Death is quantum creativity. Because when you die, you have to recreate yourself through a quantum leap. And it is the last thought at the moment of death that determines the quantum leap of creativity that calls for reincarnation. Reincarnation is quantum creativity. It's a discontinuity. You take the same karmic software, but now you create a new mind, a new body, a new context, new meaning. That is creativity. So where do I go after I die? Where do I go after I die? The answer is you don't go anywhere. You've always been there already. Okay, so if I ask you a simple question, Dr. Tully, what did you have for lunch today? Just mention one thing. Chapati. Alu, gobi, huh? Now, before I asked him that question, that gobi, which he had, the memory, was not in his brain. Okay? As soon as I asked him the question, it localized in his brain. Okay? Just like when I have a remote control button, everybody these days has a remote control button. You switch on the television. Before you switch on the remote control button, NDTV, is NDTV a program here? Okay. So before you press the button, there's no NDTV in the television set. Once you press the button, the information localizes. So too, before I asked him what he had for lunch, gobi was not in his brain. Okay, as soon as I asked him the question, that was like pressing the button and a little photon went here and he said, gobi. Where was that gobi before I asked him the question? Anybody? Non-local. It was in his soul. Even gobi is in his soul. Okay? It was not in his brain. It only got in the brain at the moment I asked him the question. And now after a little while, we'll stop talking about it. Gobi memory will disappear. Where will it go? Same place, non-local. So where do we go after you die? Same place where gobi goes after you. Forget about it. There's no difference, okay? Every moment we localize and then we delocalize. We localize and delocalize. Every thought is a localized memory or desire. Only two kinds of thoughts, memories and desires. Okay? They come from karma. So karma helps you localize and then delocalize. There's no mystery to death when you really understand this mechanism. The soul doesn't go anywhere. It just keeps localizing, delocalizing, localizing, delocalizing. And when you die, it delocalizes till it localizes again through a quantum leap of creativity. That's the creative response. And when you truly understand creativity, you recognize that it's happening all the time. Okay, that's how the universe also recycles itself and recreates itself. Because every time it recreates itself, it takes a jump. It takes a jump in evolution. Beyond the creative response is something called the visionary response. And what's the visionary response? The visionary response is that you go beyond your personal soul and you get in touch with the archetypal soul. You get in touch with the soul of the gods and goddesses that are part of our collective spiritual inheritance. And when you get in touch with the archetypal soul, the vision that comes from that changes all of humanity. So when Mahatma Gandhi touches that, humanity changes. Or when Baba touches that, humanity changes or goes beyond that. Humanity, civilization, worlds change because that soul is not a personal soul anymore. That soul has touched the realms of the gods and goddesses and gone even beyond that. That's the visionary response. And then beyond the visionary response is what we call the sacred response, where you go even beyond the archetypal soul and you get in touch with the source of all creation and become one with the source of all creation, and you actually begin to see that you are creating the universe. So you see, this is the evolution of consciousness, from fight-flight response to reactive response to restful awareness response to intuitive response to creative response to visionary response and ultimately to sacred response. And all these responses are obviously orchestrated through our biology. As we move up these responses through our biology, reality shifts, because consciousness shifts, and as reality shifts, things begin to happen which we do not normally experience in ordinary states of consciousness. And the first thing that happens is that you start to experience coincidence. The first thing that happens is that you start to experience coincidence. Coincidence. It's a very interesting word. Coincidence. What does that mean? Many incidents happening simultaneously in response to an intention that you have had either consciously or an intention that you have had unconsciously. But always coincidence is orchestrated through intention, which somehow gets into the field of a causal, non-local interrelatedness. A causal, non-local interrelatedness. That field is the field of consciousness where everything is related to everything else and everything is the cause of everything else. So this linear thinking is no longer there. Linear thinking says this is the cause and this is the effect. And this is the effect now is the cause of this. But actually when you see the non-local realm, then everything is the cause of everything else. And that's what we call a-causal, non-local, quantum mechanical interrelatedness, which means everything is orchestrating everything in response to your intention. Let me give you some very interesting stories that give you a good example of this. A few years ago, I was in England and I woke up in the morning to check my messages and I picked up the phone. And my phone wasn't working. It was dead. I was staying in a very expensive, good hotel. And the normal response when the phone doesn't work is reactive response, right? You call the manager, you say, complain, why isn't the phone working? Well, then, obviously, if you stay in the reactive response and in the fight-flight response, you're not going to experience anything mystical or profound. If things don't seem to go your way, you have to go into restful awareness and say, so what does it mean? What is the karmic significance of that? Rather than reactive. And you have to go into that state. Okay? So, I ask myself, what does it mean? All you have to do is ask a question. And sometimes the answer is not very profound. The answer to me was, don't make a fuss. You know, go across the street and use the public phone. So I went across the street, 7 o'clock in the morning in London, in a street, very misty morning, and I went inside the telephone booth. I took my credit card and I started to make a call to California to check my messages. I have a machine that records my messages. So while I was dialing the number, I had a handkerchief out and I started to play with the mist on the window pane of the phone booth because there was a lot of fog. And I must have made a little clearing in the fog, a doodle, so to speak, in the window pane when a woman passed by the phone booth. And after she passed by the phone booth, she turned around. She looked through this clearing in the fog right into my eyes and she said, Deepak. So I got out of the phone booth and I discovered she was a friend of mine. Her name is Eileen. I said, Eileen, what are you doing here at 7 in the morning? Because she lives in California. This is London. She said, well, don't you call it acausal, non-local, quantum mechanical interrelatedness? I said, yeah, shut up, what are you doing here? She said, no, it's, you know, it's what you talk about, it's synchronicity. Synchronicity means, chronos means time, synchronos means synergized or synchronized in time. I said, so, tell me what's happening. She said, well, last night, she was the producer of a music company. She worked with a band in England called the Eurythmics, which is a very popular English music band. And one of the singers of that band is a woman by the name of Annie Lennox. And she said, Annie Lennox is having these strange dreams and your name came up. And she said, I wish I could speak to Deepak. And so here you are in a London phone booth playing with the mist. Would you like to come to the studio tonight? We'll get some Chinese food. And Annie wants to tell you her dream. So I said, of course I'll come. And they're friends of mine. So I went to the studio. And Annie Lennox started to tell me her dream. And the dream was that she was seeing in her dream, John Lennon was coming in her dreams. You know who John Lennon is, right? One of the old Beatles songs. He wrote a song called Imagine. I'm sure you've heard of the song, Imagine There's No War, no... It's a very famous song. So he's coming in her dreams with that song, and he's telling her in the dreams that she should change her music because the music has such a powerful effect on the consciousness of the world, that the peace movement in the 60s came about partly because the music of the Beatles, in the West anyway. So he's telling her this in the dream, she's telling me the dream, and while she's telling me the dream, a niece of hers who's about 8 years of age, she keeps interrupting her. Auntie Annie, when can we go out? Auntie Annie, can you buy me toys? Auntie Annie this, Auntie Annie that. So Annie got a little upset. She told the girl, don't interrupt me. Go and sit over there. And if you don't interrupt me for 15, 20 minutes, let me tell Dr. Chopra the story. And if you do that, I'll take you out. But if you do, then I'm not going to take you out. So go and sit on that chair. So the girl walked across the room. She sat on the chair. And as she sat on the chair, her bottom hit a remote control button and the TV came on and John Lennon was singing Imagine. So, now how does that happen? Okay. John Lennon was singing Imagine. And she said to me, now I don't need to explain my dream to you. I don't need an explanation. It means I have to change my music. That my music has to be different. It has to be about peace. And so she's changed her music. And next thing is, her music took off in a very big way. A few years later, I was on a show in Ireland. Actually, recently, not a few years later, just about 6 months later in Ireland, at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was saying to myself, the only people who are watching this television show are people in bars, drinking. Why am I wasting my time talking about consciousness to people who are unconscious? And so, even as I had that thought, who walks into the studio is John Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono. So I told her my story. I told her the story of this experience. And she was so moved by the story that she donated the royalties of that song to the peace movement and to Amnesty International, which is, a huge contribution to the peace movement. See, this is what we call a karmic conspiracy. Okay? A true synchronicity has 9 characteristics to it. Number one, it's a conspiracy of many people who are karmically connected. It's a conspiracy of improbabilities. That's the first characteristic. The second characteristic is that the people who are involved are all related somehow, karmically. What does karmically means? They've had some karma in the past and they're having some karma again. They have shared some experience in the past and they are coming together to complete that karma. That's the second characteristic. The third characteristic is, it is orchestrated in the non-local domain. That means it has nothing to do with the world of space, time and matter. It's orchestrated in the world of discontinuity. The fourth characteristic is it moves you into a higher state of consciousness, because you start to say there's something beyond ordinary reality where this is happening. It's the world of miracles later. Okay, so that's the fourth characteristic. The fifth characteristic is you become clear that intention has something to do with it, either conscious intention or unconscious intention. The sixth characteristic is your life starts to transform. There's no going back. You're totally captivated, mesmerized by the world of spirit, by the world of soul. The seventh characteristic is you get emotional fulfillment. The eighth characteristic is you start to find meaning and purpose in life. And the ninth characteristic is you don't differentiate between the outer world and the inner world. You say the outer world and the inner world are one continuum of consciousness. That's a true synchronicity. Synchronicity. In our Vedic literature, it is called Ritam Bhara Pragya. Ritam is the Sanskrit word, which is the origin of the English word rhythm. The universe is a dance. It's the dance of Shiva and Shakti. Everything is harmoniously interacting with everything else. So Ritam is the order of the universe in Sanskrit. Ritam Bhara Pragya. Pragya means intellect. He whose mind is in harmony with the cosmic mind experiences the rhythm of the universe. And what is the rhythm of the universe? Synchronicity. Chronos means time, and synchronos means synchronized in time. And when you look at anything that's functioning in nature, it is already synchronized in time. Your body's biological rhythms are the rhythms of the universe. In your body, everything is synchronized with everything else. Every activity in your body is synchronized with everything else. In nature, everything is synchronized with everything else. So when you experience a coincidence, a synchronicity, then what is really happening is for that one moment, you have glimpsed the mind of God. Therefore, never ignore a coincidence. When you have a coincidence, you have to ask yourself, what is God telling me right now? What is God suggesting me to this? Doesn't matter how simple the coincidence is. You're thinking of someone, they call you on the phone. You go to Bombay and you say, I'm going to meet so and so. You step out of the elevator into the lobby, you see them. Okay? You want something and your best friend comes and delivers it to you. Okay? This is Ichha Shakti. Ichha Shakti is from Ritam Bhara Pragya. You have, for that moment, the human computer has plugged into the cosmic computer. So never ignore a coincidence. Coincidences are anonymous messages from God to pay attention to the field of infinite possibilities that exists beyond space-time and causality. In space-time and causality, everything is linear. But in the world of God, everything is simultaneous. And synchronicity is a glimpse of that. Yes, sir. Bas aap baithe. Absolutely. Intention thi na. So that's many incidences. Abhi recently I finished a book on this. So I was traveling. I was coming from North Carolina. I was going to a small place in Texas. There's no direct flight. So I was sitting in the plane. So in the plane there was a man sitting next to me, and throughout the trip he was snoring, he was fast asleep. we got down in Houston, so I was on the phone, cell phone, talking to my office. So my office was saying that the book, Synchronicity Ki Jo Kitab Thi, that was on the bestseller list, so I was talking to him. He must have woken up, so he must be hearing me, so he says to me, oh, so you're a writer. I said, yeah, I'm a writer. He said, what kind of books do you write, fiction or non-fiction? I said, I write both. So he said, ah. So then we got up and we were getting out of the plane. He looks to me, and as I'm getting out of the plane, he says, good luck. I said, thank you. And then he went his way and I went my way. And later on I went to the commuter terminal on the small plane to go to the small town, and I entered the plane, and the same fellow is sitting in 3B, which was sitting in the same previous plane, and I'm sitting next to him. Same situation. And he's snoring. And this time his cell phone starts to ring, so he's talking, and he's in a very bad mood. His wife is talking to him, and he says, "No, I can't do it. I don't have the time. I've got a headache. I'm running late." And then finally he says to his wife, "Acha, what is the name of this book? I'll buy it." And then he starts to write the name of the book. And it's the book that I have written. On coincidence. So he starts to write the name, the Synchron Destiny. And so I said to him, "What's your wife's name?" And he said, "Why? Why do you want to know my wife's name?" I said, "Don't worry. Just tell me what's her name." He says, "Janet." So I went into my briefcase, I took up the book, I said to Janet, with love, and I said, "Give it to your wife, you don't have to go to the bookstore." So he looks at the book, and he looks at me. He says, "What's this about?" I said, "It's about what is happening right now." So he said, "What's it about?" I said, "It's about what is happening right now." He looks at the book again, he looks at me, and he says, "Oh." Then he closes his eyes and he starts to snore again. And you know, at that moment I thought to myself, this is a great story about Lord Buddha when he was dying. His disciple Ananda came to him and he said, "Who are you? Are you God?" And Buddha said, "No, I'm not God." He said, "Are you a prophet?" And Buddha said, "No, I'm not a prophet." He said, "Are you a Messiah or some great being?" And Buddha said, "No, I'm not that." So Ananda was feeling frustrated. He said, "Please tell me who you are." And Buddha's answer was, "I'm awake. I'm awake." That was his answer. And when I looked at this fellow sitting next to me, I said, "You know, all of humanity is like this. We are all snoring. Okay? And there's a great mystery that is telling us, please wake up. The world is much more interesting than you think it is. Please wake up. And if you wake up, you will see the luminous mystery of your existence. And you will never be the same again. You will never be the same again. So don't ignore coincidence. Coincidence is the key. It's the first sign. If you pay attention to coincidence and you ask yourself, what's the significance? What's the significance? That's all you have to do. You have to go into silence and ask yourself, what's the significance? Then something will happen. A situation will happen. A circumstance will happen. An insight will come. Something will happen that will show you the karmic significance of that synchronistic experience. And the more you do it, the next stage from synchronicity is what we call miracles. What is a miracle? Miracle is the transformation of the unmanifest into the manifest. Well, the unmanifest is already transforming into the manifest. It's happening in every moment at the speed of light. On, off, on, off, on, off. When you participate in the on, off of the universe through quantum creativity, you participate in the creativity of the universe through intention, then you orchestrate miracles. Miracles. The word in English, miracle, means mirare. It means filled with wonder. You are filled with wonder because for that moment, you have not only glimpsed the mind of God, you have participated in the creativity of God by introducing your intention and orchestrating through your intention the harmonious interaction of the elements and forces of the cosmos that result in the quantum leaps of creativity that are already the patterns of behavior of the universe. So that is the key, synchronicity. Now here are seven things that you can do in order to increase your experience of synchronicity. In order to make them easy for you, let me give you seven Sanskrit words, that actually help you move your identity, move your internal reference point from local to non-local, because that's the key. As long as you're local, you will experience localities, space, time and causality. Once you're non-local, you will experience synchronicity. Okay, so that's the key. If my internal reference point shifts from my ego to my soul, from my localized skin encapsulated ego to my non-local soul, that's the key. Okay, so here are the seven words. I'll just spend a little bit of time on each of these seven phrases. The first is Aham Brahmasmi. Okay. Aham Brahmasmi. Boliye sab ikatthe. Bilkul. Aham Brahmasmi means I am the universe. Okay. With that in that simple phrase is all the truth of non-locality. Aham Brahmasmi says that the world is my body. Okay. I have a physical body which is I call personal, but I also have a universal body. You know, in Sanskrit, Brahman is the universal consciousness and Brahmand is the universe. Right? Brahman is the universal consciousness and Brahmand is the universe. So the undisturbed state of consciousness is Brahman and the disturbed state of consciousness is Brahmand. So whenever you say Aham Brahmasmi to yourself, you are reminding yourself, I am not my ego. I am Brahman from where the whole universe comes. And with that you create an intimate relationship with the universe. Because as we said, saw this morning, the universe is not outside. We are not in the universe is in us. So that's the first key phrase to shift identity from local to non-local. The second key phrase, which all you know all these phrases, is Tattvamasi. I am that, you are that, all this is that, that's all there is. Tattvamasi. Which means that what we call the other is a reflection of myself. Now, translated into psychology, that phrase, Tattvamasi, means the following. Those that you love and those that you hate are both mirrors of yourself. I'll say that again. Those that you love and those that you dislike are both mirrors of yourself. Because the other is a reflection of yourself. Who do we love? We love those people in whom we find traits that we want. We have them but we want more, so we like to be with them. And who do we dislike? We dislike people in whom we find traits that we deny in ourselves. Once you start to understand, then you start to understand that all relationship is a mirror. We are attracted to people in whom we find traits that we have but want more of, and we are recoiling from people in whom we find traits that we deny in ourselves. So I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was giving a seminar, this is about 15 years ago, and there were a lot of people, 600 people, and after the first break, a woman came up to me and she said, Dr. Chopra, I need 3 hours of your time. I said, there are 600 people here. How am I going to give you 3 hours? She said, I don't know, but I came from Mexico and I need 3 hours. I said, you came from Mexico for the course, didn't you? She said, no, that was the excuse. I really came because I want to talk to you for 3 hours. I said, I don't have the time. I said, did you talk to my office? She said, yeah, I talked to your office. So I said, if you talk to my office, what did my office say? She said, they said it is impossible. So I said, my office said it is impossible, now why are you asking me? She says, because in your books you say anything is possible. So I didn't know what to say to her. So I looked at her and I said, you know, I don't think it's going to be possible. So she put her hand on her hip like this, she looked at me and she said, "You're a fraud." She said, "You're a hypocrite. You know, I read your books and I find this wonderful person. Then I come here, you're not that person I read about in the books." So now, you know, afterwards I went to my room and I said to myself, you know, if the theory is true, tattvamasi, then why am I so upset? Okay? So I closed my eyes, I did some meditation, then I asked myself, what is it about her that I don't like? Okay, so I wrote down, impatient, angry, inconsiderate, demanding, hostile. I wrote down about 20 things. Then I picked up the phone, I called my publisher, and there was a woman in the publishing house who had traveled with me for 2 weeks. Her name was Patty. I said, "Patty, have you ever observed these traits in me?" And I read these traits. And there was silence on the other side. Then I called my wife Rita and I said, "Rita, have you observed these traits?" And the silence was much longer. So I said to myself, you know, the reason I got so upset by this woman is she's reflecting something that I'm denying in myself. That's all I had to do. I accepted that in me and her behavior changed. Because tattvamasi, every moment the reaction you're getting from the world is a mirror of what's happening in yourself. And if you accept it, if you don't deny it, if you forgive yourself for it, the world is transformed. You move from local to non-local. So those that we love and those that we dislike are both mirrors of ourselves. If you ask yourself, why do I love so-and-so? Why do I want these traits? Why do I dislike so-and-so? What am I denying myself? You move from lower consciousness to higher consciousness. You move from local to non-local. And this is what the great teacher J. Krishnamurti used to say, the relationship of mirror, the mirror of relationship. Through the mirror of relationship, we move to higher consciousness. Tattvamasi. Through the internet. Email. Yes, over a period of time. But she got it. Okay, the third phrase. Third phrase is Satchitanand. Right? Satchitanand. Because those are the qualities of your soul, right? When you move your internal reference point from ego to soul, then there is Satchitanand. Sat is the truth of existence. Chit is the truth of consciousness. Anand is bliss, bliss consciousness. When you move your internal reference point from your ego to your non-local self, then the experience is Satchitanand also. Just by reminding yourself that that's your real identity, you move from local to non-local. The fourth phrase is Sankalp. Everybody knows what the word Sankalp means. Sankalp is the seed of intention. See, if you want to orchestrate synchronicity, then you have to put the seed of intention in that mixture of dhyan, dharana, samadhi. There's a phrase now in biology, it's called teleology. Teleology means intention orchestrates fulfillment from the ground of being. And intention orchestrates fulfillment through infinite organizing power. Which means intention has the ability to orchestrate an infinity of space-time events provided it is in the field of all possibilities, provided it is in the discontinuity, provided it is beyond the skin-encapsulated ego. Today, scientists tell us that evolution is punctuated by quantum creativity that is triggered by intention. So amphibians became birds because there was the intention to fly. A camel has a long neck because there was the intention to reach up to the tree and eat that leaf. A giraffe has a hump because the intention was to cross the desert. And human beings today have the intention to become gods. Human beings at least I hope some human beings have the intention to become more than human. You know that phrase that I mentioned this morning, Rumi says, when I die, I will soar with angels. And when I die to the angels, what I shall become, you cannot imagine. Intention orchestrates. And what is intention? It's that seed, that sankalp in the field of consciousness. There is nothing more powerful than sankalp. But sankalp at the level of the soul, not sankalp at the level of individual identity. Sankalp orchestrates things everywhere. You know, when I recently have been talking about these non-local connections, and you see a lot of this in animals. Abhi, this whole episode with the tsunami, you know, in the last few days. Do you know there was not one dead body found of an animal? Not one. Not one elephant, not one sheep, not one dog, not one bird. In fact, a few hours before the tsunami happened, the elephants broke their chains and they headed for the mountains. And people were wondering, kya ho raha? Why are the elephants heading for the mountains? Okay, and they went up to the height at which level when the flood came, the flood stopped before the height. The birds went, immediately left, 2 hours, 3 hours before the tsunami came. Not one animal was killed in this whole thing. And over 150,000 human beings died. Why? Because those animals, their consciousness without their ego is already tuned in to the consciousness of the planet. To the consciousness of the planet. They can feel the conscious. Their intention and nature's intention is aligned. They know what's happening. A few years ago, a neighbor of mine, I had gone to introduce myself to him. I went to his house and I heard a voice. It said, please come in. So I went in and then I heard somebody singing, except I couldn't find anybody singing, and it took me a while to realize that my neighbor's parrot was singing a song. And I asked myself, how big is the brain of a parrot? It's about one third the size of my fingernail. It has a beak for a mouth. It has no vocal cords. It sings songs. You know why? Because a parrot doesn't say to itself, if I could sing songs, what would other parrots think of me? A parrot doesn't say to itself, you know, if I can sing a song, I'm more talented than the other person. It's just, in the field of all possibilities, in nature, intention is already orchestrating activity through sankalp. And when one is very emotionally bonded, spiritually bonded, then sankalp transcends localized time. You know, my daughter Malika, she recently gave birth to a baby. The baby is now 3 months old. We were going shopping. I took her to the grocery store, and one day we were shopping in the grocery store. She said, Papa, let's go home. I said, what's the problem? She says, Leela is crying. I said, why is she crying? She says, she's now feeling hungry. She's crying. She just started crying. I said, why are you saying that? She said, my breast is leaking with milk. You know, as the baby cries and the breast leaks with milk at the same time, even though the two are separate, because that sankalp transcends space-time boundaries. Recently we have done experiments where we take people into samadhi, we take two people into samadhi, we establish a connection, then we remove them, we take them to different locations, so we take one person to one location, take the other person to another location, put them in what is called an electromagnetic chamber, a Faraday chamber, and we take a torch, a flashlight, and we shine it in the eye of one person. When you shine a flashlight in the eyes of a person, you get a brain response that's called an evoked potential. So you take a flashlight and you shine it in the eyes, you'll get a brain response. What do we find? We find the flashlight in this person and that person gets the response also. Why? Because they're connecting on the field of non-locality. They're connecting on the field beyond space and time, where everything is linked to everything through sankalp. So that's the next phrase that you must remember. The fifth phrase, how many phrases have I given? Four. Fifth is, of course, Shiva Shakti. Okay, because the universe is a harmonious interaction of the masculine and feminine archetypal energies of the universe. If you focus only, you know, in the West what has happened is people only worship the masculine face of God. There's no Devi Shakti. Okay? And that creates a huge imbalance in the world. Right now, all the wars that you see in the world is because the masculine archetype is dominating the world. There is no attention to the Divine Mother. So when you bring back the feminine face of God, and you see the harmonious interaction of the masculine and the feminine, then you also see the synchronicity. Because loss of synchronicity is the loss of harmony between the masculine and the feminine faces of the divine energy. So just by saying Shiva Shakti to yourself, you're reminding yourself of the harmonious interaction of the elements and forces of the universe. The sixth phrase is moksha. Moksha means freedom. And moksha also means freedom from all conditioning. So before you react to anything, take a minute. Just for one second. When things don't seem to go your way, just for one step stop and say, things are not going my way. I surrender this moment to the will of the universe. When things don't seem to go my way, I trust that I don't know the big picture, but if I knew the big picture, they are going my way. That's real moksha. Okay? Moksha is understanding that my will is not against God's will. And when my will sometimes gets frustrated, then I should pause and ask myself. When things don't seem to go my way, I let go of my idea of how they should be, trusting that I don't know the big picture. That if I knew the big picture, it is perfectly the way it should be. That's moksha. That's true understanding. That's true freedom. It's freedom from all conditioning. And the seventh phrase is ritam. Ritam, which of course I said ritam bhara pragya. Ritam, the Sanskrit word ritam is the origin of the English word rhythm. Because the whole universe is the rhythm, it's the dance, it's the cosmic dance of Shiva and Shakti, where everything is harmonious, where everything is full of rhythm, where everything is synchronistic, where everything is coincidental with everything else. These five key words can be used as sutras. A sutra in Sanskrit, the word sutra in Sanskrit is the same as the Latin word sutre. And what's the Latin word sutra? It's the origin of the English word suture. Okay, so the word suture, sutre, sutra, stitch, ligature, religio, they're all the same word. A sutra in consciousness is the way to transform the world. So these are seven sutras in consciousness. You go into samadhi, you go into deep meditation, and these seven sutras, aham brahmasmi, tattvamasi, Satchitanand, Sankalp, Shiv Shakti, Moksha, Ritam. And you have the formula for synchronicity. These are the other seven spiritual laws. These are the prescription for synchronicity. And this is the gift of the rishis, who thousands of years ago, they cognized this. They understood that actually by causing little shifts in consciousness, you transform the world. You transform your world, you transform the world of your relationships, and ultimately you transform even the elements and forces of the universe that play themselves out as the elements and forces that create all